Every single day, billions of dollars change hands between people who fundamentally do not trust each other. Like, they don't know each other's names, they don't know each other's bank balances, and yet the market just never fails.
Yeah, it's wild when you actually think about it.
It is. And today, we are going to figure out how human trustworthiness was entirely replaced by, well, by mathematical certainty. But before we get into it, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Definitely check them out.
So we are looking at a very specific mission today. You listening to this right now, you are training to become a futures professional. You know, you might be aiming to be a futures commission merchant, an introducing broker, maybe a commodity pool operator, or a commodity trading advisor.
Any of those.
And to pass the Series 3 exam and actually do any of those jobs, you need to absolutely master this thing called general theory.
Which is, I mean, it's the undisputed bedrock of this entire financial universe. When we look at the structure of the exam, parts 1 through 7, which this general theory unit really anchors, they make up roughly 71% of the test.
71%?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the National Futures Association, they don't publish the exact per unit weights, but with nearly three quarters of the exam leaning on these early chapters, mastering this foundational logic is, well, it's the only path forward. You really cannot just memorize your way through this. You have to internalize the mechanics.
And we know dry lectures are the enemy of focus, right? Like, either you've got a million things on your mind, ADHD, or just a brutal work schedule. If we just read you a textbook, your brain is going to immediately check out.
Oh, absolutely. Mine would too.
So we're going to keep this moving. We'll use ridiculous scenarios. We'll ask you direct questions where you should pause and actually think of the answer out loud. And we will explicitly flag the exact traps the exam writers have set for you. The goal is for you to understand the logic so deeply that you can answer questions you've, never even seen before.
Because the exam tests the chain of reasoning. They want to know that you understand why the market evolved the way it did. Every step in the evolution of the futures market was a specific fix for a very specific problem. If you understand the problem, the financial instrument makes perfect sense.
So let's start with the origin story, a tale of price risk and, well, pure unadulterated panic. To understand why this market even exists, we need to introduce two characters, and we are going to follow them throughout this entire deep dive. First, we have Farmer Frank.
Ah, good old Frank.
Good old Farmer Frank. He grows grain. He's a hardworking guy, but he is constantly anxious because he is planting his crop in the spring, pouring all his money into seeds and fertilizer, but he won't actually harvest and sell that grain until the fall.
And the entire time that crop is in the ground, Frank is carrying this enormous financial burden. He is terrified that by the time his grain is actually harvested and loaded onto the wagons, the price is just going to crash.
Right, because of oversupply or something.
Exactly. If there is a massive bumper crop and everyone brings their grain to market at the exact same time, the oversupply will just crush the price. And Frank, well, he might not even make back his planting costs.
Stressful. But on the other side of town, we have Miller Mary. She runs this massive bakery business. She needs tons of grain to make her flour. And like Frank, she's also terrified, but for the exact opposite reason. She needs to buy grain in the fall to fulfill all her big holiday bakery orders.
So Mary is sweating over the possibility that there could be a localized drought, or I don't know, a pest infestation. If the crop yields are low, grain prices might absolutely spike before she can buy what she needs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, if the price of grain triples, her bakery's profit margins are completely wiped out. She might even have to shut down her business because she just can't afford the raw materials to fulfill her contracts with the local grocery stores.
So both of them are victims of something called price risk. Right now, the cash price for immediate delivery of grain is what we call the spot price. It's the price on the spot today. But Frank and Mary, they don't want to trade today.
No, because Frank's grain is literally still in the ground. It doesn't even exist in a deliverable form yet.
Right, it's just seeds.
Exactly. And Mary's bakery orders aren't due for months, and she doesn't have the warehouse space to store raw grain today, even if she wanted to. They both have an absolute necessity to trade months from now.
And that temporal disconnect means they are completely at the mercy of wherever that spot price decides to wander over the next 6 months. So they have this mutual anxiety. How did early market participants try to solve this? I mean, I assume they didn't just sit around and accept that their businesses might go bankrupt on a whim of the weather.
Well, they did what business people always do, right? They negotiated. This brings us to the very first attempt to solve price risk. What if Frank and Mary just meet up, shake hands, and make a deal today for a transaction that happens in the fall?
Okay, I want you to pause and think about this for a second, you listening. If Frank the farmer and Mary the miller just shake hands and agree on a price, let's say $5 a bushel for 6 months from now, what happens if a massive grain shortage hits in month 5 and prices suddenly triple to $15 a bushel? Who is suddenly sweating and why? I'll give you a beat to just think about it.
So if you worked out that Farmer Frank is the one sweating, you understand the fundamental tension of these early markets. Frank is now locked into selling his grain to Mary for $5 when he could have rolled his wagons down to the river and sold it to literally anyone else in the open market for $15.
Oh man, that hurts. That original handshake deal they made, that is what we call a forward contract. The early versions of these were actually called to arrive contracts, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like a merchant agreed to buy a commodity that would arrive later, but the price was fixed today. It was just a private custom agreement between two parties to buy or sell commodity at a set price on a future date.
Precisely. And, you know, for a brief moment, it seems like a perfect solution. Frank and Mary solved their initial price risk. Mary knows exactly what she's paying for her flour ingredients, so she can price her baked goods accordingly.
Right.
And Frank knows exactly what he's getting, so he can pay off his farm equipment loans. But in solving that problem, they accidentally created a completely new monster.
Right. By locking in the price, they solved price risk, but they created two fatal flaws that come with handshake deals. Let's talk about the first one. It's like agreeing to buy a friend's used car in 6 months for $5,000. You shake on it.
Sure.
But right before the 6 months is up, that specific car model gets featured in some hit movie, and suddenly it's a vintage collector's item worth $20,000.
Right.
I don't care how good a friend they are, there is a very high statistical probability they are going to mysteriously stop answering your text.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And that exact dynamic is flaw number one, counterparty performance risk.
Right.
The forward contract relies entirely on the specific counterparty's credit worthiness and their personal integrity. If prices triple and Frank realizes he is losing out on an absolute fortune, the financial incentive for him to default is massive. He might just flat out refuse to deliver the grain to Mary.
And if Frank bails, Mary is left with no grain, no flour for her bakery, and absolutely no backstop. She is totally exposed. She can't just call the police and say, well, Farmer Frank broke a promise. It was a private, unregulated deal. The performance of that contract rested entirely on Frank's shoulders.
And the legal friction of enforcing that contract in, say, the mid-19th century was enormous. Mary would have to take Frank to court, which takes months or even years.
And she needs flour today.
Exactly. By the time a judge orders Frank to pay damages, Mary's bakery has already gone bankrupt because she couldn't fulfill her holiday orders. So counterparty risk was a massive systemic bottleneck. People were just afraid to do business with anyone outside their immediate, highly trusted social circle.
Which leads us perfectly to flaw number two, the customization trap. Because these forward contracts were private, one-off deals, the terms were completely customized, right? Frank and Mary sat down over coffee and negotiated exactly how much grain, what specific quality it had to be, and where it was going to be dropped off. Let's say the contract is for exactly 3,421 bushels of slightly damp grade B grain to be delivered specifically to Mary's loading dock on the south side of town on a Tuesday before noon.
And that level of specificity seems great for them at the exact moment of signing. But in the financial markets, custom means you are trapped.
Now wait, you say custom is a trap, but earlier we established that Frank and Mary have highly specific needs based on harvest times and bakery orders. If you force them into some kind of rigid box, aren't you completely ignoring the actual physical realities of their businesses? Like, I like my coffee custom. Why wouldn't a custom tailored contract be the gold standard?
It's a fair question, and it's the exact reason forward contracts existed for so long.
Yeah.
But think about the liquidity of that contract. What if, say, 3 months into the six-month contract, Mary decides she is completely exhausted?
Okay.
She wants to sell her bakery business and move to Paris. She doesn't need 3,421 bushels of slightly damp grain anymore. She wants to sell her side of the contract to someone else so she can get out of the deal and recoup some value.
Oh, I see the problem. She has an asset, this contract, but who on earth is going to want to buy it? Who else in the entire city needs exactly 3,421 bushels of that specific grade of grain delivered to Mary's specific back porch on a random Tuesday?
Nobody, I mean, the buyer pool for that specific contract is literally zero. Because no two forward contracts were alike, none of them could be easily handed off or traded to a third party. The terms were simply too bespoke, too weird, and too specific to anyone other than Frank and Mary.
So if you entered a forward contract, you were just stuck in it. Your only way out was to somehow convince Farmer Frank to let you tear up the contract, and if the price had moved in Frank's favor, he would demand a massive payout to let you walk away.
Yeah, the lack of a secondary market was paralyzing. You had businesses that desperately needed flexibility, but they were locking themselves into these rigid, illiquid agreements. So the market evolved again. Participants needed a fix for the customization trap.
All right, so I want everyone listening to shake it out, sit up straight. We are hitting our first massive exam concept. The exam tests the chain of reasoning, not historical dates. You don't need to know what year this happened. You need to know WHY.
Exactly.
And the fix came when organized exchanges stepped in and introduced the concept of standardization. This is a massive leap forward. The exchanges essentially looked at the chaos of thousands of weird bespoke contracts and said, we are throwing all of this out. They mandated that every single contract for a given commodity in a given month must be completely 100% identical.
And the exchanges mandate four specific terms that get standardized. The test writers will absolutely expect you to know these four because they form the structural integrity of a futures contract.
Let's hear them.
First is the contract size. It dictates the exact quantity of the commodity per contract. No more 3,421 bushels. If you trade a grain contract on the exchange, it is exactly 5,000 bushels, period.
So if you need 10,000 bushels, you just buy two contracts.
Exactly. It's fixed.
Okay. Second is the grade or quality. The exchange dictates the acceptable quality of the deliverable commodity. But wait, what happens if Frank's harvest isn't exactly the premium grade specified in the contract? Does he just default?
No, and this is a brilliant mechanism of the exchange. They build in automatic price adjustments. The standard might be, say, number two yellow corn.
Right.
But if Frank delivers number three yellow corn, which is slightly lower quality, but still on the exchange's approved list, the standardized rules automatically adjust the price he receives downward by a predetermined fraction of a cent.
Oh, wow.
Frank doesn't have to negotiate this with the buyer. The rules are just baked into the contract itself.
That eliminates so much arguing at the delivery point. So we have contract size and grade. Third is the delivery months. The exchange sets exactly which months the contract settles in, and they dictate the very last trading day. You can't just pick a random Tuesday in November anymore.
Right. And fourth is the delivery location. They outline the specific, approved, physical delivery points where the commodity can be dropped off. It is no longer Mary's back porch. It is an approved, centralized grain elevator or warehouse that has been vetted by the exchange.
Okay, so to recap the four pillars of standardization for the exam: contract size, grade and quality, delivery months, and delivery location. By fixing those four things in place, the exchange introduced the most important word in the futures market: fungibility, the F word of futures.
Fungibility is the magic ingredient, really. Yeah. It transforms a contract into a tradable financial instrument. Because every contract for the same commodity in the same month is now identical, they are perfectly interchangeable.
Think of it like a dollar bill. If I lend you a $1 bill, I don't care if you give me that exact same piece of paper back. Any other $1 bill is completely fine because they are fungible. But if I lend you my car, I want my exact car back.
Yeah, please.
A custom forward contract is like a car. A standardized futures contract is like a dollar bill.
Exactly. Any buyer's position can offset any seller's position. You don't need Mary's specific customized contract anymore. If you want to trade grain for December, any December grain contract will do. They're all mathematically and legally identical.
And this is where the exam tries to get you. This is a massive trap alert. The test writers love to lay a trap here by asking what makes a futures contract liquid or tradable. They might offer answers about the clearinghouse or the margin requirements, but the foundational reason a futures contract can be traded on an exchange in the first place is standardization.
Right, because a custom forward contract can only be unwound by begging the original counterparty to let you out.
But a standardized futures contract, because it's fungible, it can be traded away to anyone in the open market.
And because these contracts were now highly tradable and liquid, it opened the doors for a completely new type of market participant. The people trading didn't actually need to care about the physical commodity anymore. This is where we introduce our third character, Speculator Sam.
Picture Speculator Sam. He wears a tailored suit, he lives in a penthouse apartment in the city, and he has literally zero interest in physical grain. If a truckload of agricultural products showed up at his penthouse lobby, he would be absolutely horrified. He doesn't bake bread. He doesn't drive a tractor. So what is he even doing in the commodity markets?
Well, we have to distinguish between the two major factions in this ecosystem, right? Hedgers and speculators. Farmer Frank and Miller Mary are hedgers. They deal in the actual physical commodity in their daily business operations. They use the futures market for one specific reason.
To offset their price risk.
Exactly. They want to buy financial insurance against price swings. And speculator Sam is the guy selling that insurance.
Got it.
He takes on the price risk that Frank and Mary are trying to shed because Sam is hoping to profit from the price movement. If Sam thinks grain prices are going up due to some weather report he read, he buys a contract. Not because he wants to make flour, but because he wants to sell that paper contract later at a higher price.
So there is a crucial philosophical concept for the exam here. Speculators are not the villains of the market. The popular media often portrays speculators as market manipulators, but in the architecture of futures, speculators are actually the heroes of liquidity.
Yes.
Now, I want to push on that. Why are they heroes? If it's just a casino for Sam, isn't he just adding unnecessary noise to Frank and Mary's legitimate business needs?
Think about the matching problem. Hedgers desperately need to shed their price risk. But if only hedgers were allowed in the market, Farmer Frank could only sell his grain contract if he perfectly matched up with Miller Mary's exact needs on the exact same day.
Oh, right.
What if Frank wants to hedge his crop in April, but Mary doesn't want to lock in her bakery prices until June? Frank is stuck.
The market would freeze up because the natural buyers and sellers don't always arrive at the exact same moment.
Precisely. Speculators like Sam step in to bridge that gap. Sam's always there, willing to buy or sell if he thinks there's a profit to be made. He provides the continuous liquidity that allows hedgers to enter and exit the market easily whenever they need to. Hedgers want the commodity, speculators want the price move. They have this perfectly symbiotic relationship.
Okay, so we've built this highly liquid system. The contracts are standardized. Sam is providing liquidity. But if I'm a trader looking at this from a distance, I still see a massive, glaring hole in the logic. We haven't solved flaw number one.
Counterparty performance risk.
Right. Sure, the contracts are identical now, but what happens if Farmer Frank still decides to bail when the price moves against him? If prices triple, Frank is still strongly incentivized to ghost whoever holds his contract. Cool. How did the market fix the underlying human trust issues?
They fixed it by removing the humans from the equation entirely.
I love that.
They introduced the ultimate middleman, the clearinghouse. This was the second massive evolutionary fix. The clearinghouse steps in and completely depersonalizes the buyer-seller relationship.
Let me ask you, the listener, a direct question. Think about this mechanic carefully. If you enter a futures contract today on an electronic exchange, who is your actual counterparty? Who are you legally relying on to perform their side of the deal? I'll give you a second to think about the legal structure.
It is not Farmer Frank. It is not Miller Mary. It is not Speculator Sam. It is the clearinghouse. The moment a trade is matched on the exchange, a legal process called novation occurs. The clearinghouse steps directly into the middle of the transaction. It completely severs the link between the original buyer and seller.
So it legally becomes the buyer to every single seller and the seller to every single buyer.
Yes.
If I buy a contract, my seller is the clearinghouse. If I sell a contract, my buyer is the clearinghouse.
You are no longer relying on the creditworthiness of some random person in another state. You don't care if Farmer Frank goes bankrupt, moves to Mars, or decides to become a monk and swear off worldly possessions. Your contract is exclusively with the clearinghouse. The clearinghouse faces you, and you face the clearinghouse.
But wait. If the clearinghouse is taking on the risk of every single trade in the entire market, how does it not go bankrupt the moment there's a massive market crash? I mean, if Frank defaults, the clearinghouse still has to pay Mary. What is the financial backstop that keeps the clearinghouse solvent?
And the answer to that brings us to what is arguably the most tested concept on the exam regarding financial safeguards. The backstop is margin. But we have to be incredibly careful here because the word margin is a trap.
Listen to me very carefully right now. This is exactly where the test writers try to bleed you for points. They know most people taking this exam have some background in trading stocks, so they will deliberately word questions to make you apply stock market logic to the futures market. If you know how margin works in a regular stock trading account, I need you to put that knowledge in a box, lock it, and throw it into the ocean for this exam.
Yeah, because in the securities world, in stocks, margin means borrowed money. You borrow money from your broker to buy more stock than you could afford, with just your own cash. You pay interest on that margin loan. That is fundamentally not what margin means in futures.
Wait, if margin isn't a loan like it is in my stock account, then what is it? Am I just making a partial down payment on the physical grain?
It is not a partial payment.
Yeah.
It is not a down payment. It is absolutely not a loan. In futures, margin is a good faith performance bond. It is collateral posted by both the buyer and the seller to assure the clearinghouse that they can and will fulfill their obligations.
I love the real estate analogy for this. Think of futures margin like an apartment security deposit. When you rent an apartment, you give the landlord a security deposit. You aren't buying a piece of the apartment. You aren't paying your rent in advance. You are posting a bond, a pile of cash, that sits in an escrow account as a guarantee. It says, I promise I won't punch holes in the drywall, and I promise I will pay my rent. If you behave and fulfill your lease, you get that exact money back when you move out.
And futures margin works the exact same way. Both Farmer Frank and Miller Mary have to post this performance bond, this initial margin, when they open their positions. The clearinghouse holds it. But the clearinghouse goes a step further through a process called daily settlement, or mark-to-market.
Let's break down mark-to-market, because this is how the clearinghouse actually protects itself in real time.
Right. So every single day, at the close of trading, the clearinghouse looks at the settlement price of the contract. If the price moved against Farmer Frank, meaning his position lost value that day, the clearinghouse physically reaches into Frank's margin account and deducts that exact dollar amount.
And where does that money go?
It goes straight into Miller Mary's margin account.
Yeah.
Because if Frank lost money on the trade, Mary made money. The clearinghouse transfers the funds daily. If Frank's account drops below a certain threshold called the maintenance margin level, he gets a margin call. He has to wire more cash immediately to replenish his performance bond back to the initial level.
And if Frank doesn't wire the money, like what if he just ignores the margin call?
The clearinghouse doesn't wait around. They immediately liquidate his position in the open market. They close his trade. This ensures that a losing trader's account never goes into a massive negative balance that they can't pay back. The clearinghouse always has enough cash on hand from the losing party to pay the winning party. It takes the counterparty default risk completely off the individual trader and places it firmly on the clearinghouse, backed by this daily mathematical discipline.
This is a perfect chain of reasoning. Let's synthesize it, because this is exactly how the exam expects you to understand it. We started with the foundational problems of price risk and counterparty default risk in those old 19th century handshake forward contracts.
And that pain led directly to two major innovations. First, standardized terms created by the exchange. That solved the customization problem and made the contracts fungible, meaning they were easy to enter and trade.
Second, the clearinghouse guarantee backed by margin as a performance bond. That solved the default risk, meaning the contracts were mathematically safe. You didn't have to hire a private investigator to look into the financial history of the guy you were trading with.
We have spent a lot of time defining what a futures contract is. But to truly master this material, you have to be able to compare it to what you already know. The exam heavily tests the comparative concepts between futures and securities. They want to make sure you know exactly which arena you are playing in.
Let's imagine a scenario. Let's invent a character named Equities Edward. Edward is a hotshot stock trader from Wall Street. He decides he wants to try his hand at the Chicago commodities markets. He opens a futures account, buys a December corn contract, treats it exactly like a share of Apple stock, and goes on vacation to the Hamptons. Let's walk through the catastrophic errors Edward is making, starting with what he actually owns.
The cleanest way to understand his mistake is to look at what each instrument represents at its core. If Edward buys a security, like an equity stock, he is buying an ownership interest in a corporate entity. He's a part owner of that company.
And because he is an owner, he has ownership rights. He has voting rights for the board of directors. He receives declared dividends. He holds a residual claim on the company's assets if they ever liquidate. He owns a piece of an asset that exists today.
But a futures contract is entirely different. A futures contract is not ownership of anything. It is purely a legally binding agreement to buy or sell a commodity at a later date.
So when Equities Edward goes long a December corn contract, he doesn't own a single kernel of corn.
Correct.
Yeah.
He owns a contract that obligates him to buy corn in December. Because he doesn't own an underlying asset, a futures position pays absolutely no dividends. It accrues no interest. He gets zero voting rights in the agricultural sector.
Trap alert again. If you see an exam question asking about the dividend yield on a long futures position or how voting rights are assigned to contract holders, the answer is always zero. None. Never. Treating a futures contract like an asset you own will destroy your exam score.
But Edward's biggest mistake is misunderstanding his rights versus his obligations.
Yeah.
This is the single most critical distinction you need to internalize.
Let's say Edward buys a share of stock. What are his obligations? Once he pays for the share, he has zero obligations. He has no delivery requirement. He can hold that stock for 10 minutes, or he can hold it for 50 years and pass it on in his will. He is not obligated to do anything ever again.
But if you buy or sell a futures contract, it is a binding obligation on both sides. The buyer is absolutely obligated to take physical delivery of the commodity and pay the full cash value for it when the contract expires. The seller is absolutely obligated to make physical delivery of the commodity.
Let's contrast this quickly with options, which is another derivative instrument you'll be tested on heavily later. If you buy an option, the buyer has a right, but no obligation. You can choose whether or not to exercise it. But a futures contract obligates everyone involved. Nobody gets to just walk away if they change their mind or get bored.
Right. Think about Equities Edward sitting on the beach in the Hamptons. He bought that December corn contract. December rolls around, and because he treated it like a stock, he just left it in his account. He didn't realize that by holding that contract into the delivery period, he is legally obligated to take delivery.
So what happens? Does a train full of corn just show up at his apartment in Manhattan?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, not literally a train to his lobby, but the clearinghouse assigns him a delivery notice. He is now legally required to wire the full cash value of 5,000 bushels of corn, and in return, he receives a warehouse receipt detailing exactly which grain elevator in the Midwest is holding his corn. He has to pay storage fees on it until he figures out how to sell it in the physical cash market. It is a logistical nightmare for a speculator.
Okay, so obviously Edward needs to avoid that. So pause and think, listener. If a stockholder wants out, they simply sell their shares and walk away. Their relationship with the company is over. But if Edward is locked into a binding obligation to take delivery of corn, how does he escape? What is the mechanical action he has to take?
He cannot just sell in the traditional sense of walking away. He must execute an offset. Offsetting means he enters an equal and opposite trade in the exact same contract before the delivery period begins.
We'll break down the math of that because the mechanism is brilliant. Let's say Edward initially bought one December corn contract. He is long one contract. He owes the clearinghouse cash, and the clearinghouse owes him corn in December. But in October, he realizes he made a profit and wants to close the trade.
To offset, Edward goes into the electronic market and sells one December corn contract. He is now short one contract.
Look at the legal reality of what he's done. He has a long contract that says he must receive corn, and he has a short contract that says he must deliver corn. Because the clearinghouse is the ultimate counterparty to every single trade, the clearinghouse looks at Edward's account and sees the opposing obligations.
The clearinghouse's computers say, okay, Edward, you owe us corn, but we also owe you corn. The two positions perfectly neutralize each other. The obligation is completely canceled out.
He doesn't have to find the specific person who sold him the original contract. He just executes the opposite trade in the fungible market, and the clearinghouse math zeroes out his delivery obligation.
This brings us to a massive point of confusion for traders like Edward, who transition from equities the actual definition of the word sell. The word means two completely different things depending on which market you are standing in.
Right. In securities, selling a stock transfers title. It transfers ownership of the asset. The ownership of those Apple shares passes from Edward to the new buyer.
But in futures, an open position does not convey ownership. So selling a futures contract to offset a long position just cancels a contractual obligation. No physical commodity actually changes hands.
Ownership of the underlying corn only transfers if the contract goes all the way to physical delivery. And the reality of the futures market is that the vast, vast majority of futures positions, well over 95%, are offset long before delivery ever happens. Speculator Sam always offsets. He does not want the warehouse receipt. He executes the opposite trade, captures the cash difference in his margin account, and neutralizes his obligation.
To keep all of this straight on exam day, I want to offer a conceptual framework. You need to categorize these instruments by their ultimate purpose. Here is the golden memory trick. A security is something you store. You own it, you keep it in your portfolio vault. It pays you dividends or interest while it sits there. You store it for the future. But a futures contract is something you must fulfill. Both sides owe a performance, and they must either fulfill the physical delivery or fulfill an offset. Store versus fulfill. Security versus futures. If you can keep that fundamental difference clear, you are going to dodge half the traps on this test.
I love that. It perfectly dictates everything about how these two markets function differently. Ownership versus obligation.
We've covered a massive amount of foundational logic today. We went from muddy roads and handshake deals to mathematical offsets. To make sure this is locked in, let's do a rapid-fire recap. I'm going to fire off the key takeaways, and you give us the punchy exam answer.
Ready.
What was the fundamental problem with private forward contracts?
They weren't standardized, so they couldn't be traded, and you had to rely on the counterparty's credit.
What makes a futures contract tradable?
Standardized terms created by the exchange, making them fungible.
Who is the buyer to every seller?
The clearinghouse.
What is margin in a futures account?
A good faith performance bond, not a partial payment or loan.
Does a long futures position pay dividends?
Never. It is not ownership. It is a contractual obligation.
How does a futures trader escape their delivery obligation?
By making an equal and opposite offsetting trade through the clearinghouse.
Perfect. Congratulations to you, the listener, for getting through the foundational theory. This logic is the key to unlocking the rest of the 71% of the exam weight tied to these concepts.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with a fascinating concept to chew on as you continue studying. Think about the incredible paradox of the clearinghouse that we've uncovered today.
The paradox.
Yeah, look at where this market started. Forward contracts were riddled with counterparty risk because fundamentally human beings are fallible. Buyers and sellers don't trust each other. They don't know each other's financial situations, and they know that if prices move wildly, human nature incentivizes the losing party to break their promise. The entire agricultural economy was bottlenecked by this deep personal distrust.
Right. If prices triple, Farmer Frank is highly incentivized to conveniently forget the handshake deal.
So what did the market do? Instead of trying to force people to be more trustworthy, they engineered trust out of the equation entirely. By stepping into the middle of every single trade through innovation, the clearinghouse took a market built on deep personal distrust and engineered a perfectly trusted financial universe.
We basically replaced human trustworthiness with the mathematical certainty of the performance bond.
Precisely. Today, you are trading millions of dollars in derivatives with total strangers in a fraction of a second. You aren't doing that because humanity has suddenly become more honorable. You're doing it because you trust the math of the daily mark-to-market settlement. You trust the institution of the clearinghouse to liquidate anyone who doesn't meet their margin call. You are trusting the system, not the person.
So the next time you look at a market ticker flashing green and red, ask yourself, are you looking at the price of a physical commodity, or are you looking at the price of flawlessly transferred risk? That is an incredible lens to view the market through. You aren't trading corn, you're trading mathematically guaranteed risk.
That is our deep dive for today. Keep crushing those CertQL practice exams. Keep reviewing the store versus fulfill framework, and keep pushing forward. We will catch you on the next deep dive.